Is your appetite sometimes out of control? Are you unable to stop eating even when you're full? Download our new Intelligent Medicine video, Defensive Eating, Taming Your Addiction to Food. There's a physiological basis for food addiction. The food industry has gripped our brains using powerful food science. Find out what we can do about it. Go to drhoffman.com to download this important video. We will arm you with proven strategies to change your eating behavior forever. Go to drhoffman.com. Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to focus on GMOs and a very, very fascinating critique of our over-reliance on GMOs. It comes to us from a frequent contributor here on Intelligent Medicine, Dr. Stephanie Seneff. Dr. Seneff is on the faculty of MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, she is a senior research scientist there. She received a BS degree in biophysics and degrees in electrical engineering and computer science. But lately, she's focused her attention on biology, and in particular, looking at the relationship between nutrition and health. She may be known to you for her outspoken criticism of our over-reliance on statin drugs. We'll have a little time to talk about that during today's podcast. But today we're going to focus on glyphosate. Now, what the heck is glyphosate? Well, known to many of you who are homeowners, householders, as Roundup. Roundup is something that we spray on our driveways and on our sometimes on our gardens, hopefully not messing up our plants because it's pretty deadly stuff. It kills weeds instantaneously. And glyphosate is in the crosshairs because our current infatuation with GMOs, genetically modified organisms, causes our environment to be more saturated in glyphosates. The reason for that, Dr. Seneff will talk a little bit about that. GM crops have become ubiquitous. The vast majority of our corn and soy comes from GMOs, and genetically modified organisms permit us to spray glyphosate or Roundup on our fields and kill the weeds selectively and let the good stuff grow. That sounds like a good thing, but before we, well, let's introduce Dr. Seneff now. Dr. Seneff, it's a pleasure having you here on Intelligent Medicine.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
And what I'm going to do is a little bit of a prelude to our conversation is fortuitously today, I received my copy in the New England Journal of Medicine. And, you know, usually they're dry articles on various, you know, obscure diseases and the use of new experimental drugs to treat uncommon medical conditions. But what struck me on the table of contents was an editorial about GMOs, herbicides, a.k.a. Roundup, and the public health. And I thought to myself, well, probably this being a conservative medical journal, mainstream journal read by the vast majority of doctors in the United States, it's probably going to be a pro-GMO editorial. And I was pleasantly surprised because as I read it, it turned out to be a call to action to be vigilant about the potential harms caused by GMOs. And the one of the co-authors is Dr. Philip Landrigan, who here in New York, I'm sure he's well familiar to you, Dr. Seneff, because he is in the vanguard of talking about environmental toxicity and particularly its effect on children. He's a pediatrician. He's at Mount Sinai here in New York in the Department of Preventive Medicine. But let me quote from this article. I was kind of surprised to see this. In the New England Journal of Medicine article, it says that genetic transformation has the potential to produce unanticipated allergens or toxins and might alter the nutritional quality of food. But this has been largely ignored, and a risk assessment has not really been performed to find out if this is indeed the case, as we rush to mainstream GMO products. In addition, there are concerns about glyphosate-resistant weeds. Well, what do we do for that? Then we add another herbicide called 2,4-D. If that sounds familiar to you, those of you around during the Vietnam War, that was the primary defoliant used on the jungles in Vietnam to clear our pathway to bomb the Viet Cong. And it, otherwise known as Agent Orange, causing enormous devastation among the population of Vietnam and returning Vietnam veterans. And so Dr. Landergan in this article says, in our view, the risk assessment supporting the introduction of GMOs is flawed. The science consists of toxicological studies that were commissioned by the herbicide manufacturers themselves in the 1980s and 1990s and never published. Unfortunately, not an uncommon practice in U.S. pesticide regulation. And these studies predated our current knowledge of low-dose endocrine-mediated and epigenetic effects and weren't designed to detect them. And so they go on to call for investigation of potential health effects in infants and children, and ultimately also call for labeling GMOs, so at the very least the public can be aware that they're consuming GMOs, potentially saturated with more pesticides. And so what say ye, Dr. Seneff? That seems to echo your sentiments, and it comes from a mainstream medical journal.
I'm absolutely thrilled. I think this, you might even call this a tipping point. To see that show up in NEJM is just really, really exciting to me, because it's been so frustrating that the mainstream just refuses to acknowledge that there's any problem here, you know? This shows that there's shifting sands. I mean, we're really, I think, hopefully, finally reaching enough people, and there's so much evidence. Finally, people are starting to realize that we are in a crisis here. I hope. You know, this is very, very good news that he was able to publish that in NEJM. I'm very impressed.
Now, on the other hand, you've been really in the forefront of decrying the potential hazards of GMOs and going so far as to suggest that our epidemic of autism may be related to GMO usage. That caused quite a stir. And, you know,
I know. Right. I mean,
you're no stranger to controversy, because you leaped in feet first.
I know, I'm way out there. And, of course, I've got plenty of enemies. You know, there are people who are trying to label me as a quack, you know, and if people want to believe that, they can ignore what I'm saying, but at their own peril, because I am absolutely convinced that Roundup is playing a major role in autism. I have no doubt at this point. The evidence is so overwhelming, and not just the correlations, which are stunning, 0.997 correlation coefficient, basically perfect match between the use of glyphosate on Roundup-ready corn and soy crops over the previous 4 years and the rates of autism in first grade in the American school system. It's a perfect, those two curves coincide. So this is sort of estimating the exposure to Roundup from the age of 2 to the age of 6 of the child's life.
No, but of course, you know, and you're a research scientist, you realize that correlation is not causation.
Oh, of course I realize that. I hear that all the time, you know, and I knew that going in. But, you know, the cigarette industry, you know, it's correlations that get you started. I was taking the perspective of autism, and I began looking 8 years ago. I mean, I've been interested in autism for a long time, but 8 years ago I got really worried, because I could see that the curve was exponential, and exponential growth is really scary. I mean, that will really get out of hand once the numbers get big. Right then, back then it was small, so people weren't noticing, but it was exponential, and it has maintained this exponential growth over the past 8 years since I started looking at it. And when you extend that curve, you find out that kids born in 2032, half of them, 80% of the boys, will be on the autism spectrum if that curve simply continues as it has for the past 25 years.
And you've been widely quoted with that statistic, and that's become almost a meme, you know, parts of the internet where people are concerned about environmental health.
But, right. You know, I mean, I actually put that out there in order to gain attention, because I couldn't figure out how to get the public to notice this. You know, here I am. I figured this thing out. It's devastating. It's everywhere. People, you know, pregnant women are probably going down to the hardware store, buying Roundup, applying it to the weeds in their yard, breathing that air, and ending up with an autistic child and not realizing that that's why. You know, I mean, it's so easy to avoid, but yet it's so pervasive. You know, if people would just wake up and realize this stuff is poisoning our kids, and get it off the market. You know, of course, the U.S. government is the one who should wake up, and they're going to be the last to notice, I think, because they're so heavily supported by the industry that they just want to turn a blind eye. And for some reason, they believe. You know, the Monsanto studies are really shoddy. And I tell you, my buddy Anthony Samsel, who's written several papers with me, he managed to get the EPA to give him tens of thousands, I think it's like 10,000 pages of documents. One mm-hmm. of the things they do is they have lots and lots of pages of these documents, and nothing's published. They were labeled secret. Monsanto got the EPA to label these documents secret back in the 1980s when they approved glyphosate. It was in a very lax period.
So in other words, just to reiterate, what happened was there was an approval based on the yeah. documentation that they submitted to, I guess it was the EPA, the regulatory agency. The regulatory agency looked at it and said, you know, whatever. Unfortunately, there's such a revolving door between Monsanto right. executives and FDA regulators that it's hard to tell whether the fix is on or not. But then this data was labeled top secret, kept in a drawer somewhere, and
right.
only was it a
never
free
published, never published.
Was there Freedom of Information Act that that unleashed
yeah,
that?
Yeah, he had to work hard to get it too. It wasn't just Freedom of Information handed over. He had to persist, you know. And he finally, and they finally gave Monsanto a period of time, and Monsanto didn't come back with saying no. So they said, okay, here it is, and they gave it to him, which was really great that they did that, I have to say. And of course, Anthony's been poring over this data. You know, I can't imagine the. You can't search it, you know, so it's really very difficult to dig it out. But he and I have put together a paper, which we're hoping to get published, based on what he found. And as you say, endocrine disruption. I mean, the thing is, they didn't know back then certain things. Well, maybe
for a listening audience, what tell us a little bit about what that is.
Well, and this has come out in more recent papers. Endocrine disrupting agents are really interesting because they often have a much more severe effect at very, very low doses than they do at higher doses. And I think what happened, the way Anthony and I see it, is that Monsanto figured this out because they did some studies, they did some low-dose studies. They found more cancer at the low dose than at the higher dose.
And the cancers being like reproductive cancers, like cancers of uterine cancer, breast cancer, prostate, and so on.
Right, exactly, yeah. Uh-huh. And they found these cancers, and then they were more cancers for the low dose than for the higher dose. And they said, well, this is ridiculous. You know, of course, the dose makes the poison, so how can this have anything to do with the chemical? Because it's going backwards, you know. And they persuaded the EPA to ignore that data. So partly it was their inadequate, you know, knowledge about endocrine-disrupting molecules. Glyphosate has been shown to cause tumor cells, breast tumor cells, to grow in vitro when they're exposed to glyphosate in parts per trillion. I mean, really tiny, tiny amounts of glyphosate can cause those cells to proliferate.
Well, it was just revealed that United Nations now has listed glyphosate as a, quote, potential carcinogen.
Right, right. I know. I was really excited about that. And that's had impact, too, because France, for example, has banned glyphosate for public sale as a consequence of that. And other countries in Europe are doing that, too, as well as Brazil, I think, actively moving towards getting rid of glyphosate in the open market. Now, they're still using it on their crops in France. But two countries have banned it completely, Sri Lanka and El Salvador. They've completely banned glyphosate, even for farming. And the reason is because they're having a huge epidemic of kidney failure among young agricultural workers who are working in the sugarcane fields or the rice fields where they're being exposed to glyphosate and they're developing kidney cancer, kidney failure in record numbers.
So mechanistically, I mean, because you know, we said correlation is not causation in neuroscience,
right.
So you know that you have to see, okay, fine, there's a trend, but now we have to see
right.
what is the mechanism by which glyphosate could interfere with development or produce cancer. You said, it's an endocrine disruptor. But also
right.
in your presentation, which I reviewed on the subject, you cite multiple ways in which it messes things up. So why don't you enumerate some of the ways that it can interfere with metabolism?
Yeah, I mean, it's really, truly amazing. It's an incredible molecule, and it's fascinating, actually, to me, because glyphosate becomes a probe on biology, and it's helping me to really figure out how biology works and how it falls apart in the presence of a molecule like glyphosate. Well, a big part of it is that it's a glycine mimetic. Glycine is an amino acid, one of the 21 building blocks, you know, that make up the proteins in our body. And glycine is also a neurotransmitter. I mean, it has activity in the brain. And one of my suspicions with respect to autism is that glyphosate acts like it blocks. It's like strychnine. It actually blocks glycine at the NMDA receptors in the brain. That's going to cause the neurons to overexcite themselves with calcium uptake and burn out. So it could be disrupting the neurons in that way by misfiring on the NMDA receptors. So that's one possibility. Glyphosate is a metal chelator, and in particular, we've looked very strongly into manganese, and I have a whole paper with Anthony Samsel on glyphosate and manganese, where we showed, and it was really amazing, we started looking into manganese, and it's what it does in biology, and then you look at what is disrupted in autism, and you find, oh my God, everything lines up with manganese deficiency. You know, because manganese is essential for the mitochondria to detoxify themselves. Mitochondria are the energy-generating organelles of the cell that convert glucose into energy, you know, releasing water and carbon dioxide. Really classic Krebs cycle thing goes on in the mitochondria. But they release a lot of these oxidizing agents in the process of doing their work that can be very damaging. And there's an enzyme, superoxide dismutase, that depends on manganese, which will protect the mitochondria. So if there's not enough manganese, the mitochondria have to work in a very dangerous circumstance.
And it's actually been said that autism resembles a mitochondrial disease.
Right. And in fact, many of the autistic kids have genetic defects in things related to mitochondrial function.
So that's like a double trouble.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what's happening with the genes. I mean, there is a genetic link, and they're actually interesting because there's like hundreds of genes, each of which has a tiny component of the autism community that are explained by that gene. You know, they've really done a huge amount of work with the genetics, finding that the story is extremely complicated. It's not a tidy story. You know, you could say they think autism is a genetic disease. And what I would say is there's a genetic predisposition. Mm-hmm. You know, certain kids are more susceptible. So we're getting right. the front line. And as you get more and more toxicity in the environment, more and more kids are going to get the autism because they're going to it's going to overcome different thresholds, you know.
So how do you square this with, you know, other people who claim it's the mercury in the vaccines, other people who claim it's the vaccines themselves, they have an immunological effect, other people say it's air pollution, and now we're throwing in glyphosate. Are these mutually exclusive theories about causation of autism?
Not at all. I think they're all synergistically toxic. I think the mercury is playing a role. I think the aluminum in the vaccines is playing a role. And also the glutamate in the vaccines is something that I picked up on recently. Very interesting, because glutamate is converted to glutamine using an enzyme, glutamine synthase, that depends on manganese. So there's another link to manganese. If glyphosate's preventing the cell from gaining access to manganese, and then if there's glutamate in the vaccine, which there is, for example, in the MMR vaccine and the flu vaccine, so the glutamate is injected right into your system, and your body can't convert it to glutamine, and therefore it's going to go to the brain and become neurotoxic, because glutamate is a well-known neurotoxin in the brain. It is a neuroexcitatory agent, and it works with, as I said, with glycine on those NMDA receptors. But you've got the glyphosate there, you've got the glutamate, you excite the NMDA, and you can't actually follow through because you don't have glycine. You have glyphosate instead, which disrupts everything. And the NMDA kind of gets jammed on and kills the brain, kills the neuron that's receiving this glutamate that's coming in from this vaccine. I could easily imagine that that's happening. Now, this has not been proven. These are just, my work is basically, I read huge numbers of papers. I process them through computer science techniques, and I find correlations between different words and you know, build semantic structures. And then I work out the story in my brain to figure out how does this make sense. So I'm sort of connecting the dots and saying it's plausible that X could cause Y, could cause Z, could cause autism, that kind of thing. You know, it's a really fun project. It's a fun way to spend your time, and I feel like I'm really getting somewhere with it. But what I can do is to write the paper that will say, plausibly, this is what's going on. Somebody else has to go in and do the experiment to show that that's the case, you know, but I can guide the way. I can show them what experiments they should be doing.
Indeed. And, you know, the New England Journal of Medicine article points out another problem, which is that many of the weeds themselves are becoming glyphosate resistant. So the result is we're having to drench the fields with higher levels of glyphosate. The amount of glyphosate that we're dumping on fields has gone up enormously. By the way, glyphosate made by the very same company that makes the biotechnology that helps the plants resist the seeds, you know, come from the same company. So it's kind of a, you know, it's like a vertical monopoly on that.
And very incestuous.
And this is actually not something that I realized. The result is that they're now having to use more 2,4-D, which is an even more dangerous. I mean, that's one where there's
supposed
no question about the
danger.
I mean, that's
2,4-D and also dicamba. Right,
that's Agent Orange. That's Agent Orange. I mean, we know about Agent Orange. We're still paying enormous, compensation to veterans of the Vietnam War who were exposed to Agent Orange.
I know. I think that's actually one reason why they thought it was so wonderful they were developing these Roundup Ready crops, because they thought we can stop using these other more toxic herbicides.
Right.
We'll use this Roundup everywhere, which is so non-toxic to humans. Isn't that wonderful? And if it were true, it would be wonderful, you know? But it is true that, in fact, they hadn't anticipated, and they should have, that they were going to end up with glyphosate-resistant weeds. And that's why the use of glyphosate has gone up astronomically over the instep with the astronomic increase in the use of these GMO Roundup Ready crops. And then, and now they're faced with a huge problem, because even glyphosate can't kill these weeds anymore. So now they're producing crops that have multiple resistance to both glyphosate and 2,4-D, or to both glyphosate and dicamba, which is another, you know, restricted use pesticide. And the government says, fine, no problem, go ahead. I mean, the government is being so lax in allowing this escalation of this war against the weeds, which we can't possibly win by this path. You know, it's obvious that we're just going to end with catastrophe. And we need to completely rethink how we do agriculture. And I was looking back, and it actually wasn't until the 1950s that we even had the idea of using herbicides. Kind of after the war, you know, they developed all these chemicals. And it's like, what are we going to use these for? Oh, good, let's kill the weeds, make it easier for the farmers, you know. And that caught on. That whole concept just totally bought into it. Now we just think we have to use, you know, some kind of weed killer to control weeds. We didn't used to have to do that before 1950. You know, can't we go back to that, where we find another way? I think people should be developing some kind of robotic device that can pull weeds by hand. I mean, we should be able to do something like that, you know, with modern technology, if we just realized we need to.
Yeah, that's another way
or
to do that.
Or we can actually hire people and have them do it, you know, go back to the old style.
And pay them, a living wage.
And they'll be doing that instead of taking care of people with Alzheimer's and autism, you know?
Indeed.
We'll trade that off.
No, that's a good point. But so how do you explain that the vast majority, and you're in the scientific community, and you catch a lot of flack for your views, the vast majority of mainstream scientists in the United States say, hooray for GMO technology. This is going to save the world. Don't get in the way of this, because people will starve in parts of the world where productivity has been threatened by pests and bugs. And, you know, we can feed the world's population. And people who are against this are Luddites, and are, in effect, they're elitists, because that means that, you know, Americans can buy their organic GMO-free products at Whole Foods, but people in the Sahel of Africa will starve because their crops will die.
Right. I mean, I completely disagree with that, because what's happening actually is that this whole way of using agrochemicals in agriculture, every year the soil gets worse. I mean, we're depleting the soil of its organic matter. We're depleting it of its microbes. And, I didn't mention the gut microbes, but that's another role in autism, is the disruption of the gut microbes.
Yeah, actually, let's save that point for a discussion in part two, because we divide these podcasts into two parts.
But we will talk about the soil, and the soil microbes, the soil earthworms, the rice, you know, those fungi that communicate among the plants. There's all kinds of really important things in the soil that are getting destroyed by the glyphosate. And every year the situation gets worse. Of course, there's also getting more and more chemicals accumulating in the soil. And the crop gets weaker and weaker, and then it becomes more susceptible to things like fungus infections. So now you have to use more fungicides, and those are also toxic, by the way. And so we end up with very weak plants with poor resistance to bugs, to fungus, you know, just that the plants get sick. And then we have to throw more chemicals on to fix those problems. It's it's an escalating war. I mean, we need to go back to the notion of nurturing the soil first. And when you do that, you will also nurture the plant. The plant will also be healthier to eat, because it will have more minerals. You know, the plants are deficient in micronutrients.
Actually, some studies show that organic plants actually, you know, ounce for ounce, gram for gram, have a higher concentration of micronutrients than conventional produce. That's been demonstrated.
Right, I've seen that. And you mentioned earlier in the beginning of this interview that that paper talked about the differences between the, that they are not substantially equivalent. I mean, they have this notion of substantial equivalence between the GMO and the non-GMO crop, and then they don't prove it. You know, and in fact, they don't even define what it is. And then they get something like 40% statistically significant differences on the amino acids, just the amino acid distribution of the plant. That really says the proteins are different, by no question, you know. And yet they say, well, that's substantially equivalent. I mean, they do a lot of hand-waving. It's not rigorous science by any means.
Indeed. All right. Well, this is a good point at which to pause, and I promise you that in part two, Dr. Seneff, we'll talk a little bit about the effects of glyphosate on the microbiome, that is, the bugs that inhabit our intestinal tract that increasingly we're recognizing play a major role in sustaining our health, even mediating our metabolism, which may determine whether we're fat or obese. That's going to be in part two of today's discussion with Dr. Stephanie Seneff, the subject, glyphosate and GMOs. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.